Hello, I'm RP. I'm a sustainability professional involved in impact investing in social enterprises.
And I'm Sam, an advocate on the role of technology in the pursuit of social innovation, nation building, and sustainable development.
We're both from the IGP's MSC Prosperity Innovation and Entrepreneurship Program.
And welcome to
The Prosperity and Beyond.
Another amazing guest. So are you ready for this, RP?
I sure am, Sam. For this episode, we have with us a man who wears so many hats and we've lost count already. He's the founder of multiple successful organizations such as Biobean and Skyroom, Fast Forward 2030, Key Worker Homes Fund, and also an advisor for the Museum of the Home.
Yeah, as if that's not enough to keep his time occupied, he is also an entrepreneur in residence at UCL and serves as a visiting lecturer at Imperial College London. His work has been recognized by the likes of the UN, The Guardian, Bloomberg, MIT Technology Review, and many more. So, without further ado, let's all welcome Arthur Kay.
Awesome to be here, guys. Thank you very much for having me.
Great. Thank you so much.
So I think just as an icebreaker, because we're all new, we're all friends here. So you are a founder of the startup Biobean. Do you still drink in coffee chains?
I do, yeah. So I'm a big coffee drinker. I've got one in front of me right now.
Oh, nice.
And I drink, not so much in chains. I often drink in independent coffee shops and make a lot of coffee at home, but not the big chains, really.
Oh, but are these the coffee shops that Biobean services?
Biobean services, yeah, coffee shops and coffee factories. So we work with companies like Nestle, who have Nescafe brands, as well as Starbucks, Costa Coffee, Cafe Nero, people like that. Yeah, so a real range of independent coffee shops all the way through to the biggest coffee companies in the world. Yeah.
And with that, like, what is your standard coffee order?
Simple, just a black coffee, maybe a long black, something like that. So kind of a strong, short coffee. Yeah.
Right.
Very direct, very straightforward.
Yeah.
Can't go wrong with that, I guess.
Yeah. Yes, honestly, I think that's a lot of people's standard order.
Yeah.
Not for me. I'm not in that. But yeah, thank you for sharing that, Arthur. And perhaps we can now dive into more interesting questions about your background and your personhood. Starting with, okay, we did a little bit of digging on your LinkedIn. We're so sorry about that. Just a little bit of stalking. But we noticed that you have 9 active roles in a wide range of organizations. So obviously the most prominent of them being the founder of Biobean and also Skyroom. But unknown to many, you also advise the likes of Museum of the Home. And we're just curious, out of all of these commitments, do any of them really just pop out and give you the most fulfillment? And if so, can you identify that?
Yeah, so I hope my LinkedIn is up to date, because yeah, that sounds like a lot of roles. But I do quite a number of advisory roles and teaching positions at various universities as well. And the thing I don't necessarily enjoy one the most, is more the range of different activities that I do. I find very enjoyable and stimulating. So it's kind of spending time, for example, teaching on the Prosperity on Innovation and Entrepreneurship course at UCL.
Right.
Whilst that may seem like a activity where you kind of just talk to the students, such as yourselves are so amazing that you get a lot of energy and ideas back from that too.
Yeah.
So it's the range of activities in and of itself is what gives me a lot of energy and a lot of optimism as well.
Right. Maybe just a quick follow-up question. At the top of your head, was there any memorable moment that you had recently that you are, I guess, keen to share, or like just really, I guess, energizes you?
Yeah, so this was must have been about a month ago, and I was walking through the new Battersea Power Station development and saw a shop from a project that I'd been one of the mentors and student advisors on whilst at Imperial. One of my students there had gone all the way from kind of a sketch on the back of a napkin probably 4 years ago now to a large retail store looking incredible in Battersea Power Station. So that was really exciting and inspiring to see something that had gone from you know, a twinkle in someone's eye mm-hmm. 4 years ago, all the way through the kind of the innovation and development cycle to being a kind of high, you know, next to the Apple Store and next to Lululemon in Battersea Power Station. Right. So that was really exciting.
Yeah, it's like seeing tangible success from like scratch work that you've been doing.
Yeah.
And even and the success, I think, is part of it, but it's more. For me anyway, it's more people making brave decisions to try and get things off paper and to happen in the real world, because there's an awful lot in terms of people wanting to do things and talking about doing things and not. So for example, you guys going and actually doing this podcast, so many people, I've had probably 20 podcast ideas, but I've never made a podcast. So many people will think about making a podcast but and say, really wouldn't that be cool? Never do it. And it's not, you know, as you know, it's not the hardest thing in the world to do. You need to book a guest, you need to get the kit together, you need to work it through, but it takes work, and it also takes bravery to put it out there and say, this is who I am, this is what I stand for, and this is how we're going to go about it. And so it's that's the stuff I like seeing happen.
Thank you for acknowledging our work in this. In other things that we also digged around, we also found out that in one event that you promoted entitled "Is the Pursuit of Happiness Making Us Miserable?" What like key principles from this activity do you still remember, and how do you think answering this question contributes to one's path towards prosperity?
So this was an organization I set up with a friend of mine when I was studying architecture at UCL, and it's called Students for Happiness. And it was all around how people could look after their health and well-being in a more sensible way at a time where the debate, this was probably 12 years ago now, so the debate was pretty nascent in the UK in terms of talking openly about mental health challenges, wellness, that kind of stuff. Obviously that's now changed materially over the subsequent 10-12 years, but at the time it was pretty unusual. And this particular event was looking at how we're told that we should be a certain way. We should be, you know, up at 5:30 a.m. meditate for half an hour, drink your kombucha latte thing, then do this or the other.
Yeah.
And it was more kind of saying, actually, the knowing what, in inverted commas, is the right way to live or the right way to do or how to be happy sometimes is actually pretty unhelpful, because people, for example, who do have, a lot of my friends have suffered from pretty serious mental health issues, for example, and they feel everything in my life is going well, why am I feeling depressed? And it's a very thin understanding of what is kind of wellness and mental health issues.
Yeah.
And so, and the pursuit of it is an admirable goal, but often the idea that one must be happy, or you're wrong if you're not happy, is I think where that event was framed around.
Yeah.
But I say this organization, Students for Happiness, started in about at university with my then girlfriend Georgie Gilmore, and in the subsequent years we took it to a few other universities as well. So one, University of Oxford, the London School of Economics, and then University of Toronto, Canada.
So like even back then you were already sort of interested with this idea of not necessarily prosperity, but then in this understanding how we pursue things to be happy.
Yeah, well, the things I've done in a kind of more entrepreneurial sense, or setting up organizations or doing creative projects, it's usually from the perspective of, does something like this exist already? And so it was very much looking from the perspective of, this doesn't exist now. There is not a open, calm, sophisticated conversation around, in this case, happiness. And so it was looking to try and create that. And we did get a lot of amazing speakers for it. We had people like Sir Anthony Seldon, Lord Richard Layard, John Lloyd, Theodore Zeldin. So we had some really impressive and inspirational speakers who came and kind of shared their insights and wisdom with us en route, which is great.
Wow. Even during your undergrad, you were doing so many things already. But yeah, just to jump on the next question. So you are the founder and chairman of Fast Forward 2030. And since you started this in 2016, can you share with us the biggest developments that you've seen in this space and how they're contributing to attaining the UN SDGs?
Yeah, so the idea for Fast Forward 2030 was Henrietta Moores, my co-founder and co-chair of the organization. And I remember very vividly us talking about it straight after the kind of they were launched, basically. And it was very clear at that time that there was a coherent plan for government in terms of how they could tackle the SDGs, a coherent plan for big business and NGOs about how they could tackle the SDGs, but entrepreneurs, particularly early stage entrepreneurs, were completely left out of the conversation.
Right.
So there wasn't even an organisation to try and coordinate, even at the most simple level, some of this stuff. And so again, it kind of started from this point of saying, this should exist. Why is there not a voice for this group? And why is there not activity or coordination happening around this?
Mm-hmm.
And so we started Fast Forward 2030. And what we do there is, technically, it's kind of, we call it a think tank, but it's essentially we kind of organize events. We write some white papers. We provide a framework and support structure for early stage entrepreneurs, and particularly try and get people who are thinking of starting a business and try and tilt them to do one that has a social, environmental, or economic positive impact.
Right.
And then for those already starting a business that is in that sphere, we try and give them the support, the network, the peer-to-peer learning, the insights from, you know, both the Fast Forward 2030 network itself, where we have podcasts and events and stuff like that, but also from the connection with UCL.
Mm-hmm.
And so today we're kind of operating in 3 different countries, in the UK, in Lebanon, and in Kenya.
It's so much that you've done so much at such an early stage that it makes me wonder what was the inspiration for you to become an entrepreneur? Like, you're involved in various enterprises, and I'm sure, like, entrepreneurs, like, you have an origin story. What was the origin story for you to become an entrepreneur?
So technically I'm an entrepreneur, and that's how I set up and run organizations. I don't necessarily think of myself as that. It's more, it's more I'm creating things that sometimes happen to be organizations in response to either gaps in markets or challenges that need tackling.
Right.
So it's more I'm kind of working with teams of people to try and coordinate action for things, rather than specifically being interested in being an entrepreneur. And actually, my starting point was I studied architecture at UCL, and my starting point was around how you can try and make change in cities, and that's always been my interest in terms of how you can use the city as a lens to be able to create change. I decided not to become an architect and instead to go down a route of running organisations, and that was a view that I had and still have around it not being the most effective way to make that change I wanted to see. So to kind of skirt around your question, I'm saying I happen to do creative projects that end up sometimes with companies at the end of them, and they're in response to
solving a problem.
Right. Or seeing something that isn't yet being addressed and trying to address that.
Do you think in this pursuit there were particular pitfalls that still haunt you? And whether or not, how were you able to bounce back from these kinds of pitfalls?
So a huge number of pitfalls en route. I can go into some examples shortly. In terms of bouncing back, I mean, in terms of acknowledging my privilege, I'm kind of born into a middle-class family in a global megacity in a prosperous country as a white heterosexual male. So it's kind of, I've had a lot of a very, very fair start and strong start in life in terms of being able to have some of that resilience to be able to work through it, and also personal stability to be able to kind of work through some of those more challenging times. So entrepreneurship, especially at the moment in countries like the UK, is very weighted toward, and is not particularly spoken about in the discourse, but it is weighted towards people from a middle class background, people who've had some maybe university education or something like this, and it's a luxury in many ways to be able to pursue riskier ventures and to take those risks without necessarily the feeling that you're going to go bankrupt or end up on the street.
Right.
And so it's a big, big standing start that people like I have had to do that, but not many call that out.
Mm.
And in terms of like the pitfalls that you sort of wanted to highlight?
I mean, these range from, everything you can imagine, ranging from people trying to steal my company from me multiple different people, multiple different times, multiple different companies, through to our factory burning down at Biobean, through to you know, having physical threats of violence from people, through to being blackmailed by someone once, through to, you know, you name it, all sorts of weird and wonderful things. And then, you know, you have kind of, you know, more lighthearted ones as well.
Right.
So yeah, a lot of you know, learnings en route, and and some serious, ranging from almost criminal things happening through to just, you know, kind of usual kind of someone messing around trying to nick things from you.
So, like, connecting from what you said prior to this, do you think, like, the background was able to sort of cushion how you pivoted, or were you able to build, like, sort of a support structure for you to be able to sort of withstand or pivot on when something like that happens?
I think it's the ability to be quite resilient in face of those things happening, and then also not to, like, bad stuff will happen, so acknowledging bad stuff will happen and then working through it when it does in a relatively methodical way. So I'm pretty good at being able to separate out things. So for example, I've got friends who run companies, let's say, and they'll be, I don't know, something bad will be happening in their company and that will ruin their social life, say, or their, you know, their time with their partner or their mental health. And I guess what I'm pretty good at, from it's not necessarily all good in terms of this, but what I'm good at in terms of as an entrepreneur is I'm good at being able to segment out things that are going wrong in my personal life, say, from my professional life, and be able to put that in a clear emotional box, and then also between companies as well. So let's say I sit on the board of a museum, as I mentioned, and let's say something's going wrong there, and then something's going, I won't let that, or I'll try not to let that, I'm quite good at not letting that filter over into my day job, say, and vice versa.
So what I got from that is compartmentalization is key, so that you can handle different situations and different stages of your life
with
various, like, engagements and whatnot.
I'm not necessarily sure that is always a good thing, in terms of, I think probably a therapist who may have some views on if that's a healthy way to behave.
No, the NHS.
But certainly in terms of being able to look at a challenge directly and be able to try and address that without necessarily, obviously there's some maybe emotional crossover that I'm not acknowledging here, but without bringing the stress of that to that situation and being able to kind of switch off quite effectively.
Yeah.
I think it ultimately is like a muscle that you have to sort of train to be able to separate the professional and the personal in that aspect.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, you don't want, if you are very passionate of a particular problem and solving, you don't want it to get worse by a very quick and unthought of reaction.
Yeah.
Caused by a totally unrelated thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's interesting that you don't identify as an entrepreneur, even if you have all of these organizations that you sort of, like, founded. But we're curious, like, even if we've had a lot of developments already, it's already 2023 for that matter, but it's still quite difficult to establish yourself in this space, especially if you don't have the right connections, the right backgrounds, and the right, I guess, like, networks. So how did you establish yourself and, you know, really put yourself out there as someone who is credible and legitimate, even if you did not necessarily have the right skills to begin with? And what was your process in building your team?
So in terms of, from a standing start, the industries that I kind of was building my first businesses in were essentially renewable energy, biochemicals, and waste management. So, and we ran, you know, large factories, developed products, set up supply chains. So that was and I was, when I set that up, I was kind of early 20s. So that was a relatively kind of high technical and needed high credibility in order to kind of make it in that make it in that industry. So very different from, let's say, a kind of personal finance app, say something like that, which is kind of got other challenges, but it's you're not going to die if it goes wrong kind of thing. Whereas, you know, if a factory blows up, you know, people can get hurt and that kind of stuff.
Right,
so there's a need for both a credibility to secure investments and customers and set up supply chains and partnerships, but also to make sure that things were safe and secure and run properly. So again, acknowledging some privilege here. A lot of it was being like a 6'2" white guy probably helped. and also from like, you know, I studied at UCL and had, you know, a few family connections, this kind of stuff. So the kind of combination of that gave a kind of a start to be able to kind of get into certain, into rooms, for example. However, there's a great line in the Simpsons movie, which is Tom Hanks is playing himself, and he says the EPA has lost its credibility, so they're borrowing some of mine. Oh. And so it's this idea of basically, if you are, you know, in this case, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, had lost its credibility. So, however, Tom Hanks is the most beloved actor in America, so they're borrowing his credibility.
Right.
So what I've worked at and think is a hack or shortcut for entrepreneurs who are looking to build credibility, whether this be in actually any industry, is to, it's a, essentially a logo collection game. And so you, for example, you know, partnering with other organizations, winning prizes, getting press, getting this kind of, so essentially you're kind of working to kind of as a ancillary benefit to be able to get those logos, and then you can, for example, let's say get a, for example, I'm a fellow of the Royal Academy, of Engineering, and so I can get a quote or an endorsement from the Royal Academy of Engineering and put the logo on my thing and say that, you know, I'm not an engineer, however, the Royal Academy of Engineering thinks Arthur's great because they said this about him, and he's a fellow there. And
that definitely helps.
So if you're trying to build credibility in a space, that is a relevant badge to collect.
If it's
let's say in my example earlier of a personal finance software app, it might be the equivalent from a, you know, economist at the London School of Economics. It might be from a well-known personal finance blogger. It might be from a Trustpilot review or saying, you know, whatever it is, kind of thing. So it's how you build that credibility early on, even when there's not necessarily that much substance behind it.
Yeah, makes sense. I mean, you just have to put yourself out there. And I guess since you quoted The Simpsons, it's sort of like sounding like Pokemon. You gotta catch them all.
Exactly.
Honestly, I think, and also to segue to the next question, it's really, there is no straightforward way to sort of what the path is when you're beginning a venture. And as both of us are Pi students, and you are also teaching a lot of entrepreneurs from the IGP, we are relatively in the budding stages of our career in solving these wicked problems. If it was possible for you to tell us, like, how were you able to design the solutions that worked, and what were like key factors in like that you were looking into in assessing the viability and scalability of these solutions? I think you've glossed over some earlier, but like, if you can be more specific.
So a lot is around starting with your customer and understanding what they want. And I think I'm not necessarily very good at doing this always myself, but trying to understand very, very clearly, is there a actual customer need for this? I think a lot of people, and again, I've done this, build what they think should exist in the world rather than a specific need that they may have experienced themselves or that they know a customer experiences. And I see a lot of people waste a huge amount of time and money going down that thing with forgetting who the customer is. And obviously that doesn't necessarily always mean that the customer has to be right, as in sometimes that, you know, there's the famous Henry Ford line, if I asked a customer what they wanted, they'd have asked for faster horses instead of the automobile. And so that doesn't necessarily mean saying which product would you like. There's a way, I'm sure you're familiar with kind of design thinking and the methodology in terms of how you can go about understanding what customers may or may not want, rather instead of literally just saying, do you want this product? And so there are ways to get to that outcome, but that's kind of the key piece. From that, then there's a whole bunch of technical things that one needs to work through to end up on it, and also understanding what you actually need to build versus what you can buy. And so to give an example of that, at BioBean, we made a decision, I think maybe the right, maybe the wrong decision, but a decision to build an entirely vertically integrated business, which is a very unusual and quite rash thing to do. So we decided to own R&D ourselves, to own the supply chain ourselves, to own the factories ourselves, to own a chunk of distribution ourselves. And so we were literally, you know, developing and designing products from scratch. We were doing the engineering to make the machines to make the product. We then were building and operating factories, and then we were selling products at the back end, all within a very small startup company. So that's a very unusual thing to do, to try and vertically integrate a small business versus to do that. Versus with Skyrim, what we're trying to do is be the interface for coordinating a number of existing operations. So we try and partner with major landowners to build new floors above their existing buildings, and we then coordinate a supply chain behind us, which is a construction industry supply chain using, in our case, sustainable modular housing. But we have made a decision not to vertically integrate to build a modular housing factory, for example, or to become a specialist designer of certain kinds of niche things. We're trying to own the relationship with the landowner and coordinate that as a development manager rather than as a vertically integrated supply chain. So understanding which piece within the supply chain is the value added piece is really essential, because if one can spend a huge amount of time redesigning things that already work very well rather than procuring them well. Let's say, for example, if you wanted to set up a really good coffee shop, you may choose your USP to be, okay, we do source our beans very effectively, or we have the best baristas, or we have whatever it happens to be. You're unlikely, for example, to become design your own coffee mugs or develop the point of sale system for your coffee shop, or to become an architecture company to then refit your coffee shop yourself and do all the designs and things. So you're understanding which of the USPs you're going to focus on and get very good at and design versus just procure. And most people should procure most things and decide what's the one thing or two things that you're going to become the best in the world at, and then focus on that.
Do you think this particular journey of figuring out what your USP is, like, is an easy one or something that entails so much reflection from the central entrepreneur?
I think it's quite often an intuitive thing, and people can miss, again, myself included, can misunderstand what their actual USP is. Mm-hmm. And so it does take a lot of thought and reflection to get to what it is, but it is quite an intuitive thing. So it's not something that necessarily working hard at it will mean that you get to the answer of what it is. It's not a number crunching exercise or not a particularly academically rigorous exercise. It's pretty intuitive and understanding actually what's going to make you different in the market. And a lot of people lie to themselves about what that actually is. I've got a friend at the moment who I believe is doing this at the moment. He's lying to himself. He's setting up a company and thinks that his USP is an actual USP and it's a fake USP. It's a different way of doing, and I've told him this many times, but he won't listen. But it's a different way of doing the same thing, and he's convinced it's different enough that it's going to be completely game-changing for the industry. And okay. But essentially, you could buy it from 50 places off the shelf now, and he should procure it and focus on his USP, which could be phenomenal execution, for example, or could be better distribution, or better procurement, and you manage your costs very well and you've got a better margin so you can offer your product more less expensively. So fake USPs are a big danger.
Fake USPs. Never heard of that concept, but it's quite interesting. That, well, it is, I guess, a phenomenon for some people to believe that, hey, this is something that would really change the lives of everyone. But at the end of the day, they're just sort of deluding themselves. Like, oh, well, not exactly. But, I guess some people need to try it out before they really realize that, okay, it's not going to work out.
Yeah. Or at least understand where the challenge is. Let's take an example of, tackling malaria in sub-Saharan Africa. So I got a friend who was doing this for a time, and they kind of redesigned the mosquito net. The issue was, she came to understand, the issue wasn't actually that the mosquito net was not a good, or it was not, you could buy very inexpensive and effective mosquito nets now. It wasn't a better mosquito net would solve the problem more effectively. It was a distribution problem and a usage problem in terms of if people will get it to the people who need it and will they use it once they get it.
Yeah.
And so it's trying to solve it through having a better mosquito net is neither here nor there. You could have a mosquito net that costs even less and was even more effective, and it still may not get to the right people and still may not be used.
Yeah. Makes sense.
That was a very dense first half of the podcast.
Yeah, so maybe we can take a quick break so that people can sort of like absorb everything.
And we're back.
We are back. What a break. And now we're going to, I guess, probe a little bit more about your businesses, starting with BioBean. So it's been around for about 10 years. And for those who don't know, it's the world's largest recycler of spent coffee grounds. So what can you say is the most important impact it has produced thus far, and how were you able to achieve that?
So BioBean turns spent coffee grounds into a range of advanced biofuels and biochemicals. So we make a range of products like biomass pellets, biomass logs called coffee logs, and then a range of higher value materials, for example, Infocaf, which is a biomaterial, and then a range of flavors and fragrances, so the stuff that makes coffee taste and smell like coffee. The stuff that gets me most excited in terms of impact we've made thus far is around the kind of tens and tens of thousands of tons each year that we divert from landfill and anaerobic digestion, and the kind of savings in terms of CO2. And we can count two savings here. The first is diverting waste from landfill or equivalent, and that saves CO2 because it stops, in this case, methane degradation, which is a very 27 times more potent than carbon dioxide, in fact, and then means that you avoid that. And then in addition, we can displace conventional fuels. So and indeed virgin materials. So instead of burning coal or wood, you can use coffee logs or biomass pellets. And then instead of using virgin materials such as wood or plastic or whatever it has to be, is we can use Infocaf. And then instead of using virgin coffee to make natural flavors and fragrances, we can use our still natural derived coffee, but from spent coffee grounds rather than from virgin coffee grounds. All of that means that we've collectively saved hundreds and hundreds of thousands of tons in terms of CO2 emissions. Mm. And we've been recognized as B Corp, kind of best in the world in terms of the environment as well.
I think it's quite impactful for like a startup that just relatively 10 years old.
Yeah, 10 years is a short time, especially for a lot of businesses when you compare it with, let's say, for example, traditional organizations that have been around for like centuries or something around that number, basically.
Yeah, and I think another venture that you have that you also gave us some insight a while ago was Skyroom. It's a bold attempt to solve land scarcity issue in megacities like London. Like, what was the inspiration for that particular business, and how do you see the organization evolve moving forward?
So the original idea for Skyroom was actually very similar to BioBean. Whilst they're seemingly very different businesses, what they both try and do is make value from waste. Or in the case of BioBean, it's wasted stuff, spent coffee grounds. And in this case of Skyroom, it's wasted space. In our case, we're looking at empty or underutilized rooftops. The initial idea for the company name, in fact, was Waste of Space instead of Skyroom. And specifically what we do with Skyroom is we work with major landowners to add new floors in the airspace above existing buildings. And we, at the moment, are operating in a few different countries, but mainly focused in the UK, as you say. And in terms of, I guess, the idea there and why it makes sense is the main cost of a house in a city or a home in a city like London is not the architecture or the building itself, it's the land upon which it's built. And so we keep trying to, you know, to the point around fake USPs we were touching on earlier, to try and make a house affordable is very, very, very difficult if already 70% of the cost of the end product is the land. So even if you were to almost put a building there for free, you've still got something that's, you know, got 70% of the cost built into it. And so that's why you can, for example, spend, we're here in Bloomsbury in central London, where if you were to buy a, you know, let's say a 1,000 square foot flat, that would probably cost £1.5 million, maybe £2 million. But for exactly the same flat, if you were to move it to rural Wales, you could buy that flat for probably £75,000.
Right.
So it's a, you know, many orders of magnitude difference in terms of how much that flat costs, and that's the land. And so our insight was very crudely that if you could get what's called suitable urban building land, so land that you can build on, in places where people want to live, so not in this case, not in rural Wales, they want to live in Bloomsbury, you can materially reduce the end cost. And specifically what we do is we do it for key workers, so people who need to be near to their place of work in order to deliver their job. So you can't have a nurse, it would be very hard for a nurse to live in rural Wales and work at UCL Hospital, UCLH, and therefore they need to be within a proximity of UCLH to be able to do that. And so our kind of theory of change is around if you can get those people near to their place of work, i.e. delivering the 15-minute city concept for London's key workers, you then will have a direct impact on them, which is, you know, better retention of NHS staff. Most of their income already goes on housing, so you can reduce housing poverty, a whole range of impacts there, but also the knock-on effects to our public services will be very positive, because then you have, instead of a nurse being stressed and underpaid and overworked and feeling like society doesn't care about them, you have someone who is in a, you know, a much stronger position personally and able to therefore do their job more effectively and support patients and have a positive knock-on effect to society.
Who do you say would be your, like, your key customers for Skyroom? Are those people like NHS, because you say that they benefit more for having their staff near, or is it the original building owner in which Skyroom is being built upon?
It's a great question, and it's a question we struggled with for a few years actually, in terms of understanding that, because the end user is the person who eventually occupies the house or flat, and that's typically a London key worker. However, we realised that our customers, in fact, are major landowners. And so we've refined our business model somewhat to be able to actually focus on them, and we're still kind of tweaking it in terms of that. But the role that we take in the supply chain is a development manager, and we provide the kind of development management services, but also bring a range of technologies and different unique approaches to the built environment to be able to actually deliver this, because it's a relatively technical product to be able to build, you know, between 2 and 10 new floors above existing buildings. So it's quite a hard thing to do. And so our company focuses on how you can do that and offer that as a service to building owners.
Is there a danger that these building owners would just impose the same amount, the same like preventative structures or rental structures to these healthcare workers with this new floor in their building?
Yeah, so we typically do between 2 and 10 new floors, so it's significant amounts of new massing. But through the process, which in London it's managed through something called, or in the UK it's managed through something called a Section 106 process. And so that's a legal obligation that you enter into with the local authority to deliver a certain kind of housing. So through the planning process, that gets agreed and ironed out with the landowner.
Interesting. I mean, I feel like at this point we've covered so much already. Like, all of the topics that we've discussed have been a lot to absorb for sure for our listeners. So perhaps we can end on a lighter note. We noticed that you're a keen reader. So what do you think is the must read for innovators out there who are trying to advance sustainability or address grand challenges like yourself?
Yeah, so I read a lot and think that a lot of entrepreneurs should read, or, you know, listen to audiobooks, or have they learn best, because it's a very, very important thing to kind of think more broadly beyond your industry and area of expertise. So my first thing, I guess similar to your earlier questions around what I enjoy reading, and it's a very, very broad range of stuff, so I don't actually read that much within, let's say, sustainable entrepreneurship. I'm usually reading books about, you know, history or politics or design or engineering, whatever it has to be, or kind of culture and that kind of stuff. I read quite a lot of non-fiction, but things I'd recommend if people were kind of getting started in terms of being an entrepreneur, I would say Robert Greene's work is good, Laws of Human Nature, which is kind of, I guess, more like a, what would it be, pop psychology maybe. Peter Thiel's book, Zero to One, is good. Again, he's a very divisive and controversial character, but it is a good framework to think about delivering. His focus is particularly kind of entrepreneurship in software and in Silicon Valley, but it's an interesting, a very well-written book and an interesting approach on it too. So those would be my kind of starting points from it. And then, but the overall approach to reading would be read random stuff that's not obviously relevant to your sector and look at how those ideas can kind of cross-pollinate and help your existing thinking.
Right, yeah. Right.
Well, thank you so much, Arthur, for like taking your time off from your very busy schedule to entertain this podcast.
Yeah, he only has nine other organizations. No big deal, right? This man has so much time on his hands. But thank you so much, Arthur. It's been a pleasure having you, and we hope that you enjoyed your time here as well.
I had a great time. Thank you very much for doing such a great work with hosting and, more importantly, for setting up the podcast, which is amazing and takes a lot of bravery and initiative. So well done, both of you.